The morning light.
The morning light is always a very special, precious time. It's a time when the world is waking up. Everybody is looking at life a little differently. They're seeing brightness of the day. They're seeing happiness of the day. They're seeing the great things that are foretold for the day. And sometimes it's not such a great thing. Now, right now, as we look out at the morning light, we see it breaking across the mountain here. And there's a ridge of beautiful glow of a pinkish light coming along there above the light blue. And above that is a deeper blue and sort of a little cloudy sky. But nonetheless, the light breaks through and it says, "Good morning, everybody. Ready for a good day? Ready to wake up and have fun today? Ready to see the excitement that the day has to bring?" And we all say, "Yes, yes, yes, Lord, yes, Lord." And the Lord is within us. And we're talking to our inner God. And we say, "Yes, Lord." And what does that mean when we say, "Yes, Lord"? Does that mean that we say, "Yes, controller, I'm ready to land"? Or does that mean, "Yes, myself, I'm ready to be all that I can"? What does it mean to you? What does it mean to you as you look at the morning there and you see the light breaking brighter and brighter, and yet it's still quite dim? But it's lighting this side of the mountain a little bit now too. It's getting so bright. Before, this side was just a dark line on the ridge in the sky. There was a fellow. He lived on a ranch. He lived on a mountaintop retreat, farm, whatever you want to call it. And he had a barn, and he had cows in the barn, and he had a house, and the house was a distance from the barn. In Europe, they don't usually make it so far from the barn. They often make the barn and the house one. But this house, this and barn, were separated by at least 300 feet. So, this morning the farmer got up and he was going to go to the barn and take care of his cows and feed them and milk them and take care of them. And it was a whiteout blizzard. So strong, so definite, you could not see your hand in front of your face. It was really very definite. Now the farmer said to himself, "When I walk out my door and I walk straight ahead, 300 feet, there's the barn." Well, the farmer walked out the door and he went the proposed 300 feet and no barn. He didn't find anything. Now he had to be a little careful because there were cliffs near his property. And if he walked the wrong direction, he would drop off a cliff, which would go down several thousand feet. Quite an amazing place where he lived, and quite nice. So he sat down, he said to himself, "If I can see the barn in my mind's eye, I can walk to it." He said, "Now, I have left the house. Obviously, I've gone a direction that the barn was not. So let me just close my eyes now and see where the house is and see where the barn is." And so he closed his eyes and he could mentally see the house and see the barn. And he could see where he was walking, right toward the cliff. And so he decided, "Well, now the sensible thing for me is just to believe in myself and believe in the mental image I have and either walk to the barn or to the house. Now, I've been out here for quite a little while. I think it'd be a sensible idea to walk to the house and get warmed up." And so he mentally set his triangulation for the house. And within, well, 2 or 3 minutes, he's back at the house. And he said, now, if I can walk back to the house because my mental sight was so perfect, I can certainly walk to the barn. So he sat down and had a cup of coffee and relaxed a little bit and warmed up, because he had been out there for a few minutes and he didn't expect to be out there that long. And then mentally he said to himself, I know where the barn is. I know that I know that I know. And it's not hidden. It's right there. The only thing hidden is the view. If a fog had dropped in, or if it was a heavy rainstorm and I couldn't see very well, but this is a blinding blizzard. And I must get out to my cows and take care of them. So he set his sight for where the barn was, and he visualized the barn. He sat in his kitchen chair before he got up, and he said, now, I can see my barn. I see exactly where it is, and I will walk a true course to it. Now, you see, it's a very dangerous thing that he might have considered, that cliff. I mean, you walk off that cliff, and nobody takes care of the barn. Nobody takes care of the cows, and he just is ready for his next dimension. But that wasn't in his thought in the slightest. His thought was that he wants to take care of his animals, and he wants to do the things that are normal for him to do. So without having a second thought in his mind, he sat there, he visualized the barn, he had that picture strongly in his mind, and when he had it strongly in his mind, he walked directly to his barn. And he milked his cows. He fed the cows and the goats and the sheep. He took care of them all. And after he took care of them, the blizzard still raged. So before he went back to the house, he thought to himself, I'm going to use the same intelligence. So he sat down on the milking stool, and he closed his eyes and said, I see the house. And he got up from the stool and he walked directly back to the house. And at that moment, the whole sky burst into fire, burst into light, and the storm stopped in just that moment. And he turned around and he looked where he'd been, and he saw that he had made a perfect path, straight as an arrow, from the barn to the house. And he knew he had done the same thing from the house to the barn. Now he taught himself, the morning light is always there, but that inner light is even more positive, more dynamic, more beautiful, and more effective than the morning light. Because what he could see with the morning light was the imagery that was all around him. But what he could see with the inner light was the wisdom of all knowledge, the ability to say, I know that I know that I know. The divine in me guides me wherever I wish to go, to do whatever I wish to do. And living as he did in the crags of the mountains, he oftentimes had to go places that were rather precipitous. And so he would just boldly climb whatever his task called for him. But now he sat down. He meditated and he said to himself, I know the best path up the mountain. And he took the best path, a path he had never taken before. And he went straight up the mountain to the higher pasture. And it was full light, full day. He could see everything, but he had never seen this path because it was just slightly out of the way of the path that he normally took or that the animals took. We sometimes miss our path. We miss our direction because we don't sit down for a moment and listen to our inner self. Now, it's not that it takes time for your inner self to talk, but it takes time for you to listen. And when you sit down and listen, the morning light dawns in your consciousness. And as the morning light here is changing from a whiteness to a pink, to a red, and now to an orange, so the awareness within your consciousness changes from sort of a half-aware to a full-aware. And the divine in you takes over and gives you the full story of just what's the right way to go and the right thing to do. But let's all learn to sit down and give our divine an opportunity to come through and share with us all that it is and all that we are. But it takes time to sit down and not rush off, because the task is waiting for us. But if we prepare ourselves, the task will be very easy, and we'll walk up a new path that we never knew was there, equally as effective and far more gentle and interesting to use. So this day, I see each of you taking a moment of introspection before you make your task, and then your task is light and your burden is easy. I love you. I'm taking a tumble. How many people know how to take a tumble? Well, Ingeborg is one. She knows how to take a tumble. Ingeborg was over at the pool one day, and as she was running around the pool, like she was told, boys and girls, don't run around the pool. She was running around the pool, racing to do the something or other, as only Ingeborg knows how to race to do. And she took a slip, and she looked like the wreck of the Hesperus. She was skinned up one side and skinned down the other side. And I don't know, did he see you? No. Well, we did. We saw her. When she came home, we said, Ingeborg, who did this to you? And she said, the sidewalk. And we said, Ingeborg, go in there and put some WD-40 on it right away. So, that other stuff. Neosporin. And she says, well, there's not a tube of Neosporin big enough for this. I said, that's right. So we're going to take you off to the hospital. So we took you to the hospital, right? We didn't take you to the hospital?
She was alone when it happened.
Don't mess up my story with the facts. We didn't take her to the hospital. She didn't have to say that either. I could have just said, we took you to the hospital. This is my story, you know.
Yeah.
We took you to the hospital. And at the hospital, they said, well, where is she in all this blood and pulp here? And so they had her stand in front of the fan, and then everything blew back into space, into place. And all the sutures were done, and she just said, I am whole and perfect. And the whole audience in the hospital emergency room looked at her and said, Messiah. But truly, when you speak your word, healing takes place. And you spoke your word without going to the hospital that the healing took place. And what did you use on it? Did you use any Neosporin? Did you use any goose grease? Did you use any urine? Did you use any mine? What did you use?
I killed it with water, that was all.
Just pure water. Well, when you're good, you're good, I tell you. We should have recognized at that time what a good healer, practitioner you are. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But everyone needs to learn how to take a tumble. When we have Button here, and Button jumps from my arms and is further down than he thought, he usually takes a roll. And he just comes out racing for what he wanted, thinking about it. And then when Button is chasing with Little Love, and Little Love's a little smaller than him, he'll get Little Love, and Little Love will go rolling across the room. And Little Love loves it, and Button loves it. And now that we have Snuggles here, and Snuggles is half of Little Love, and just about a quarter of Button, Snuggle goes up to Button and says, bat me, go ahead. And Button bats him, and he goes flying across the room. And then Snuggles come back and says, that was fun, do it again. do it again. It's like a daddy grabbing the kids by their arms or their legs and swinging them around. My goodness sakes, if the kid ever hit the pavement with his head or something like that, I mean, goodbye kid. But and if Papa, for some reason or other, loses his grip, or the clothes come off, you know, you're holding the kid on his legs and holding his pants, you know, and off comes his pants, and there goes the kid sliding across the pavement. We do things like that. But there's a certain resilience, a certain ability to take a tumble that children do. Mm-hmm. I think children would be dead, 10 minutes out of the tube if they didn't know how to take a tumble. Because the first thing they do is to tumble out into the hands of the doctor or the midwife or something like that. And they say, golly Moses, this is not cool like it was inside there. That was nice and soft and cuddly. And here I come out in this world. Wah! What are you doing to me? Except for the smart ones. The smart ones tumble out and they say, well, bless my soul, this is very nice out here. I'm glad I was born. They do. Usually it's a little English accent, you know. And how would they say that with an English accent?
By golly, it's nice out here. It's quite charming. I'm really pleased that I'm here.
Excellent. Excellent. I think you do that British thing quite well. A little bit of Kiwi in there, but it's mostly British.
Rather.
But you see, this is what the British kids say when they come out. And that's why the British kids are so intellectual right away. They send them off to, what is the undergraduate, the lower grade school for the kids? Eton? Where the kids go to school first?
Eton is
one. They go to, Eton's not a big school, it's a little school, right? For little children. Don't you know your British theology? Well, anyhow, they have Oxford and they have other schools over there. And the kids go from the lower school to the upper school. And when they go to the lower school, they get out of their diapers. And because they didn't know what to put on, they have these long coats. And so they have nothing on underneath these coats. But then after a while, then as they grow up, they realize they can put on the long pants, and they can put on the waistcoat, and they can put on all these other good things. But they take a tumble out. The British will love me, aren't they? They take a tumble out, and they get started in life just beautifully, and they have very few problems. People, dogs, cats, children, who can handle this, perhaps that's why they said, rock-a-bye baby in the treetop, you know, when the ball breaks, the cradle will drop. That's so that the kid will have his first fall and not be touched by it. He just fall down, break an arm or leg or something like that, and he'll say, hey, that wasn't too bad. I came out of that all right. And people, they say, oh, you always have a fear of falling because your parents have that fear in their mind and you lost your balance. Well, actually, when you first fell out of the tube is where you made your first fall. And if you handle that well, all the rest of the falls throughout your life are a snap. And it must be that way for most of us because we handle things quite well for the rest of our life after our first fall. And you know why we weren't so worried? You know why? Hmm? Anyone can tell me why we weren't so worried? If Irene were here, she could tell you. We had our bungee cord attached. We weren't worried. We weren't worried. Right to the middle here. And so we had our bungee cord attached. And so as we came out, what was it worry about? You know? A little bouncing, that's all. And I quite imagine that's the case. I quite imagine that when the mother drops a child and the child goes down to the ground, the bungee cord, the placentia is hanging in there, and the bungee cord allows them to come just so far, you know, the umbilical cord. And so then they come down, whoosh, down almost to the ground. And then what does the mother do? The mother animal eats the placenta and eats the bungee cord, that is the umbilical cord, and chews it off. And she doesn't tie it in a knot. Have you ever seen a cow who can tie a knot? I have never seen a cow who can tie a knot. And cows have babies all the time. Healthy kids, strong, sturdy, and horses. Bambi, did you see Bambi's mother tying the knot? No. And did Thumper help? No, he just laughed. He just had a ball. But you see, this is the game of life. We have to learn to take a tumble. You never thought it was going to be like this, did you? We have to learn to take a tumble in life and not be touched by it. Just to flow with it and have a ball. And, you know, as I walk the path in the black of night oftentimes, and I know what's there and I know what's coming, but I'm not sure that my foot is going to be where I want it to be. I know it is, but somebody might have changed it, like the rain or something, you know. And so I take my hands out of my pockets while I'm walking through that area, and then I put them back in my pockets after I'm past that area. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's pretty cool in the morning. It gets down to below zero and zero, and it's pretty cool. So I have to put them in my my pouch, you know, from the kangaroo. And even the kangaroo, the little Joey, he comes out. He's still attached by that umbilical cord. And he stays attached for quite a little while, as I understand. And when he's unattached, it just sort of shrivels up and drops apart. But he's being fed through that umbilical cord for quite a little while after he is born. Is he just a little tiny guy inside there, and the mother's certainly not giving him milk from her teat or something like that, because that's on the inside. And that's what he does, doesn't he? He searches around until he finds that teat inside the pouch and grabs a hold of it. But then, if his mother is athletic at all, she springs and flies from hither and yon, and he goes to the bottom of the heap again, and he has to crawl back up and find the teat so he can have more milk, and he hang on for dear life, and I think they're fully tear their teeth like that. But they learn how to tumble. The kangaroo joeys, they really learn how to tumble, and they are good tumblers. They, you know, we should really put them all in the contest. What do they say? A kangaroo can jump much farther than a human being, which is not any surprise. And many animals can run faster than human beings and leap farther and do neat things better than human beings too. But you see, it's all part of the game. It's all part of the wonderful game of being a living creature. Now, just think of this. Here you are. You're planting your seeds. And your seeds have been fertilized. And then your seeds grow hair. They grow a little fuzzy top. And the wind comes along and lifts them up and flies them off hither and yon to parts unknown. And then the seeds land on hard ground, soft ground, good ground, bad ground, and they grow plants, weeds and things like that. You know the kind. And they grow everywhere, but they're not worried about the umbilical cord. They're not worried about where they fall. And what about these chestnuts? My God, the tree is a couple hundred feet high, and then the chestnuts fall down. What a landing for a seed. And then it's a fertilized seed. It's a seed that can grow a chestnut tree. I mean, when you consider what nature does and how nature likes to teach you how to take a tumble and do it in such dramatic, graphic ways, it's surprising. Now, you never thought about nature having all of its creatures take a tumble. And what does Mama do to the baby bird? Out, kid, you're time to fly. But, Ma, I like it here. I don't want to leave home. Out. You fly down there, you can fly back up here. I guarantee you, you're not going to fly back up here anymore. You're going to go out and investigate the world. But you're welcome to come home if you want. No, Mama, I want to stay here forever. Out. And Mama boots the baby out of the nest. Does she hate the baby? No. And the little bird goes out there and he says, oh, I'm going to die. Ah! He flaps his wings and he starts to fly. And he just has the greatest time. And then he loses his sense of Mama. He loses his sense of where his home nest is, where his home airport is. And so he's flying around thinking, where's Ma? Where's Ma? You all look alike from this distance, you know. No snifter, you know, no way of telling. So he's on his own. And Mama says, good riddance. Now I can have a slight pause in between the next batch. But that's all part of the game, isn't it? Part of the game. Just think, the birds have to do that. Now, what does a rattlesnake do? They lay their eggs too. And what does a turtle do? They lay their eggs too. They lay their eggs up on the sand and then they waddle off to the ocean. And they let the eggs hatch themselves. and thousands of little turtles come clucking down the sand to find the ocean. They know which way the ocean is. Now, you think, why don't they lay them in the ocean so they wouldn't have to go so far? Well, the trip from their eggs spot to the ocean is just what they need to build up muscle strength to swim. Otherwise, they would just float. You know, if you don't have to swim, you float. You know that. And so this is why they learn how to float. This is why they learn how to tumble. Everyone learns how to tumble. So when mommies take the privilege of tumbling away from little kids, I don't mean tumbling out of their nest, sleeping area or whatever, but from falling down and getting up by themselves and mending their own ways and finding that life is a great joy. This is a divine pattern. It's a divine pattern. Now, it doesn't have to be that way. You can create an entirely new divine pattern. But when you do, you won't remember the old divine pattern. You'll be a totally new person. You'll be living in your spiritual reality, and you'll have forgotten all about the past. And you'll be living in the now. And you won't remember how you did it before. You'll forget all about the fact that you had an umbilical cord. There's no hole in the middle of your tummy anymore. No spot where you'd been eating while you're gestating in your mummy. And that day will come. That day will come. Because all these things are just games we play. All these things just games we play. And isn't it fun? I'm taking a tumble. A lot of fun. Stand up and dance. A lot of us enjoy looking at a puppy dog. And when the puppy dog is hungry or looking for attention, they'll stand up on their hind feet and they'll bounce around. They'll do all sorts of marvelous, magical things that they don't do otherwise. And then you say, come on now, stand up, stand up. And they don't. They do what they want to do when they want to do. They stand up and dance whenever they want to stand up and dance. Well, the same goes through for you and for me. We stand up and dance when we want to stand up and dance. And we lay down and cry when we want to lay down and cry. Now, the comment was made this morning that the story of the man with the broken jug or the cracked jug, that wasn't our philosophy. Well, there's nothing that isn't our philosophy or is our philosophy. The total story would seem to be not our philosophy from the point of view that you acknowledge that everyone has a flaw, and that flaw can be their blessing or their curse. And mainly we think of the flaw as a curse, as something that is not beneficial to us. And so therefore, in that light, we would say it's not our philosophy. But if we look at it as beneficial, then we say, well, that's not our philosophy either. We don't look at a broken leg and say, well, we got a broken leg, and, you know, that's a beneficial thing to us. Well, what brought you to the school of the master? What brought you to the philosophy here? What brought you to your husband or your wife? What did you walk into the restaurant and you were looking around for your friend and you tripped over their chair and fell right in his lap? And he says, well, hello, what a wonderful person you are. You just seem like you belong here, you know. And you say to yourself, please, you know. And then you stand up and you stammer away. And then you think to yourself, my God, what a charming fellow. And I should have stayed longer and got to know him and said hello. But that your flaw could have been your blessing, you know. And it could have been not too, but it depends on how you handle it. You have to learn to stand up and dance at the right time. And at any time, if you feel good about something, take a moment and say, just a moment, gang. No, I didn't get your name. Your name is what? My name is Mary Jones. Your name is John Jones. Oh, hey, that's all right. And where do you live? What's your telephone? And he'd say, hey, are you trying to come on to me? No, I may do that later. It's just that you're interesting and I don't want to lose contact with you. I mean, when I find something that is a beautiful flower, a beautiful rose, I'd like to learn its name and learn more about it. And if it's something that'll interest me later, fine. If not, that's fine too. It's my choice. I can say yes or no to anything in life. I can stand up and dance at any time I want and take in the show and become part of the show or just become an observer of the show. It's up to me. I can do anything I want. So we have to learn to always be ready to take the initiative. Whenever it comes our way, take the initiative. Here you are, here on the top of the mountain. The wind is blowing like the devil, or like the wind. And it is blowing tremendously. And you think to yourself, my, 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 it is blowing tremendously. My, that wind is blowing tremendously. My, that wind is blowing. Oh, that wind is blowing. And with each affirmation that the wind is blowing so tremendously, you feel insecure. You feel your footsteps are not sure. You feel you're not warm enough. And so, as a metaphysician, you instantly say, hey, click! That wind is beautiful. Gentle. So gentle. And all of a sudden the wind becomes gentle. And that wind is warm and pleasant. And you take off your jacket. And you say, wow! All this snow around here, and this light breeze, and I'm warm. Have you ever taken off your shirt on the mountaintop, as you were skiing or something? Sure you did, because the upper weather was very warm. Where the snow was, it was cold. But where you were, it was very pleasant. And you were very comfortable. You could even be naked up there, and you'd be very comfortable. But the point is, you decide what the music is that you're going to dance to. You decide whether you're going to be traditional and say, oh, that wind, and oh, it's cold, and oh, it's terrible. As I walk along the path in the morning sometimes, the wind seems to come whistling along, and really a cold wind, and I say, ah, another Santana. And just like that, the wind seems to turn and become very lovely and very warm. And when I'm not thinking about it, I'm walking along and I'll say, oh, the wind is cold, and I wrap myself up in my shirt or whatever. And little by little, I get colder and colder. I say, hey, 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 you know, what kind of music am I dancing to here? Am I telling myself a story that I don't want? Do I want to be cold? John said this morning, oh, I like this. It's my kind of weather. Kind of weather from South New Zealand, along with the Antarctic weather there, the ocean, the cold ocean nearby. He says, this is brisk and lovely. Well, that's great. But I notice that John is in Southern California and not in Southern New Zealand. Now, why is John in Southern California and not in Southern New Zealand? Because he finds this very salubrious, very delightful weather. He's standing up and dancing to the music of Southern California, and he enjoys it, doesn't he? Now, when he feels the coolness, it reminds him of when he was a child. And when he had to run around with his mittens on and his coat and his hat with the flaps down and so forth, because it's cold down in the south part of the island. You know that, don't you? Have you ever thought of being up in Canada? You know what Canada is? You know what Alaska is? They're cold places. That's the same thing with the southern tip of New Zealand. The only reason that New Zealand is more habitable than Canada and Alaska is that it has Gulf Streams that float down there and bring a little more warmth to the coast. But nonetheless, in the Gulf Streams, they also bring along an iceberg or two as they come floating along, because that's a cold area down there. But again, what kind of music are we dancing to? What kind of a drum are we dancing to? What kind of a beat? Are you dancing to the beat of somebody else's drum or your own? Well, today is going to be a cold and windy day. You'll all have to put your mufflers on today. Be sure to put your boots on, because it's going to be wet and sloppy outside. And so the radio or television forecast goes on and on and on. And then he's in the middle of the forecast. He says, whoops, just got a change in from the weather report. It seems as though there's a breeze from the south that has just come north, and it has changed the entire weather picture. The rain has been blown away before it came onto the land, and weather is going to be lovely today. It'll be swimming type weather today. So have a wonderful day, y'all. And then by the time the radio program, whoops, the breeze from the south changed and is now heading east instead of north. And, and inside of a very short time, these things can happen. Now, you say, oh, that's silly. That's not silly. Who was thinking about it? Somebody was thinking about it. Somebody was thinking, John was thinking, hey, I like this coolness here. That's kind of nice in Southern California to give me a little reminder of home. And then he has this little reminder. And then I think, no way, I like it cozy. I like it cozy, warm. And I find it very wonderful. So here John is wrapped up in his coat and he's feeling this cool breeze. And here I am, naked as a jaybird, walking along, warm as toast. And John says, aren't you cool? I say, aren't you hot? And you see, whatever we are, whatever we're doing, we create our world about us. We create it by our thought. We create it by whatever it is that is the type of music that we're standing up and dancing to. But a lot of times we don't stand up. We just listen to the radio or television. We hear the weather report and we say, oh dear, that's what it is. Instead of saying, not no, not no, not protesting, just saying, oh, the weather outside, delightful. And if you want it to be frightful so that you can stay inside and enjoy the fireplace, well, that's okay too. But it's whatever type of music you want to stand up and dance for. Now, what do you want? What kind of music do you want? What kind of environment do you want? What kind of outside air do you want? Do you want to have it be beautiful? Do you want to have it be warm? Or do you want to have it be somebody else's beautiful? Do you think an Eskimo would feel very comfortable down here in Southern California? You could get used to it. But at first the Eskimo would say, I'm roasting, you know. And of course he's got so much fat and blubber on him that he needed to have up in Alaska and up in the Arctic that he would be like that. A guy coming down here from Iceland. He fell off his boat in the middle of the Icelandic cold water there, was in the water for 6 hours. They pulled him out. He's perfect. He wasn't fat. He was just normally built, but he had the attitude that he was comfortable. And the water was cold. The water would freeze the fish, but it didn't freeze him. It's a story from a magazine that they were reporting on. It's amazing. Now, that seems an impossibility because that is the way it is. But yet, you take these people who dive under the water and swim for long distances underneath the ice, and just their swim trunks or whatever, and then they come up in another ice hole further along. I mean, that's just the very fact of claustrophobia, you know. You can't come up there. There's no hole to come up into, you know. And you swim to the place where there is a hole, you better be a good aim. You better know where that is because, you know, you're off by a degree this way and that way. There's no hole. And that would be frightening. And, of course, the panic would kill you too. But these Norwegians, they're used to doing that. Some. I wouldn't say all of them. I would say maybe 5 or 10 out of a couple thousand, 50,000 maybe. Because if it were everybody, it would be no story. But since it's a few, it's a story. Now, what kind of music are you standing up and dancing to today? Are you standing up to the music that all of your work is done smoothly and perfectly? Are you standing up to the music that your teeth are in perfect order? Are you standing up to the music that says Our puppy is well trained, and that when he goes to May's house, May and Kip are just going to fall in love with him. What are you standing up for? What did you expect? When we went to May and Kip's with the dog, did you expect the dog to be accepted or rejected? Did you think perhaps that Kip would think he had too much to do? Whatever thoughts were going through your minds, that's what you experience. And if you can't tell me that you all expected Kip to accept the dog. May did. We knew she would. I mean, who could refuse that little guy? But Kip didn't. Now, why didn't he? Because of our thought. Not his thought. You see, Kip doesn't exist as a thinking person aside from us. May doesn't exist as a thinking person. Your parents don't exist as a thinking person aside from you. Your parents think what you think they think. May and Kip think what we think they think. Everyone thinks what we think they think. Each other here, we think what they think. We think what we think they think. You'd be a good tongue twister, can't it? But what is that all about? What that's all about is we are the creator of our world. We are the master of our world. We have to stand up and dance to the music that we're performing. And if the music is not very nice, then that's the dancing that's not very nice. But if the music is superior, wonderful, fantastic, glorious, you can create the best orchestra in the world playing for you. If you like the old-time orchestras of Tommy Dorsey, Harry James, and so on, they're playing right now. They're on tapes, they're on disc. And when they're playing it just like we had it back in the 40s. Wonderful, back in the 50s. Wonderful. Just like I remember it. No difference. Because they're playing it from then on the disc to now. It's quite a thrill. Now, who creates that? Me. Who creates it? You. Now, what do you want? Well, stand up and dance for it. Because that's what you're doing anyhow. Have a wonderful morning. I love you very much. The runway. John loves our dogs. And he loves our cats. And John thought he was going to build a runway for our cats.
John's day.
And that's right. So John built a runway for the cats. Now, Snuggles, I think it's time for you to be lifted up and snuggled for a little while. Okay? That's a good boy. So John made this runway for the cats because the cats had a rather high climb. They had to go all the way up to the windowsill from ground level. And so John put in this little tiny kitty door, and the cat walk, he could have made it narrower because the cats can do anything. But the cats walk up and down there just without any carpeting on it or anything like that. You know, just John just really is not a cat person. And so he didn't dress it up like, you know, you go into the cat store and the dog pet store and they have it all padded so that the cats can, you know, claw at the carpeting and stuff like that. Well, you didn't do that. You just left it naked out there. Well, anyhow, the cats don't seem to mind because they go right on up there and they go right in the door and they go right out the door and they just treat it like it's just the Hilton Hotel. And for them it is. Because Spot has the nest right under the window, and so you come up and you can pet Spot, and then Spot will take off if you want to pet too long. But Magic has the bookcase and has her pad in the bookcase, and Micho and Gentle are on top of the food cabinet overlooking the cars. They like the active area. And so they all get along just fine on that board. Well, now John wants to tempt fate. He wants to put a board out in front for the doggy door, for the doggies have to go up at least, oh, maybe a foot and a half. And so he put this walkway out there. And the other two dogs, Button and Love, they can handle anything. But little Snuggles is, I don't know, maybe he's a foot long, is he? Something like that, maybe? He's about the size of Love here. A little shorter legs, being a Maltese. And so he goes out that door, and he's not sure about him. He likes the front door here, where he goes out, and he can go right onto the front front porch out there, a nice big area to get out on. But when he goes out this other door, he's got to go down the ramp. And so he begins to put on a show, and he's balancing himself, and he's going like this and going like this. And if we had made the ramp 2 feet wide, he wouldn't have thought a thing about it. And yet he still only takes about 4 inches of the ramp to walk on. But John put, what is this, 2x6 down there for them to walk on. And they just find that ramp most interesting. Love and Button come up that ramp. They just stand like they're parading in a clothing store, showing the newest styles. But little Snuggles, he wants to pretend that he's having a hard time. Well, Snuggles has proven himself to be a master. He's been here only a couple of days now, and Button used to go after Snuggles because Snuggles was cutting in on his territory, playing with his friend Love. Now, he recognizes that Snuggles is a little guy, only 9 weeks old, and that when Love dashes for Snuggles' neck or something, just having fun, turning him over, rolling him around, Snuggles having the time of his life. And Button comes over and says, now just remember, Love, be gentle with Snuggles. Snuggles is just a little baby, not so tough. And he even takes a nip at Love and says, I mean what I say. He's acting like the father or the big brother for these two kids. But he's doing a good job. Isn't this how many of us are? We have an opportunity to walk down the runways of life, and we play games at it. Instead of being just wonderful and flowing with these things, we have to sort of strut or stroll. Now, we saw Marcello. That's the grandson of Ellen. And Marcello was, I believe, 13, wasn't he? And Marcello, 13 or 14, somewhere, he is a young Italian boy. And he knew it. And he strutted around here as though he were a peacock. If we had had a walk for him to strut down, he would have loved to strut on that runway, showing off how beautiful he was. And he is a beautiful guy. But with that comes a lot of confusion. With strutting comes a lot of confusion because nobody takes you serious. Nobody takes you serious as that you're really a person who knows what you're doing. And so as Marcello was going to school, the kids in school didn't take him serious. He would go up to each one of them and say, you're God, you know. And they'd say, oh, come on now. But he would be gentle, but people just didn't take him serious because he was a strutting peacock saying, I'm God, glad I am, you know, which is beautiful. But this is something that even adults find it difficult to get along with. So when you're strutting down the runways of life, be real cautious. Be self-confident. Be humble. Be meek and mild. You don't have to prove anything to anybody. Just do your own thing and have fun. But don't do it in opposition to other people. Because when you do your thing in opposition to other people, everybody's going to try to find ways to cut you down. I'll show that guy a thing or two. I'll cut him down a peg or two. You know, you've heard little terms like that. And that's only when people are showing off. Only when people are pretending they're superior to other people. And this is something that we all want to be very careful of. We don't want to be at any time superior to anybody else in anything we do. One woman that Ellen was looking for wrote a letter, and her letter was from last January, and I'm finally getting to answer it. But she attended our seminar in New York, Jackie Coogan, and she writes, "When are you going to have a Way of the Master seminar? I want to come to a Way of the Master seminar." So I told her. I said, "We're holding three of them in Europe in October, one in Berlin, one in Basel, and one perhaps in Zurich, or wherever we're going to hold it. And you're certainly welcome to come to any one of those. But we do recommend, before you come to the Way of the Master or the School of the Master, you have a underlying foundation of what our teaching is, so we don't have to do the groundwork there." So it'll be interesting to see what she does, because she is the spiritual spiritual director of her church, and she has six ministers over her, but she's the spiritual director, and she is a practitioner and not a minister, which sounds very interesting. I have a feeling that she runs the show, but she plays low man on the totem pole because she doesn't have an ordination. And it'll be very interesting to see what is going to happen next time we meet, because she's a remarkable lady. But she walked into our seminar with another white lady, and the seminar was black. Everybody was black there. We had maybe two or three white people in the whole auditorium. And so she walked in with her friend, and they were well known to the black community there. And they walked in, and they sat there like, "Yes, here we are. We're the pompous ones. We are the ones who know it all." I don't know if they ever hear this. And then after a little while, Ellen got up. And then Ellen said, "Let's all sing together, 'Now I Like Me.' Let's all sing together, 'I am God, God I am.'" And she had them singing and singing and singing. And she pointed to the two ladies, "Sing, sing, you know." And the two of them were sitting there, you know, sort of looking askance at the other people in the audience. But our black friends, wow, they really sing. And they sing with all their heart and all their soul and all their being. They really come out with fantastic power. I love it. I would trade one black for a dozen whites any day. Sounds terrible, doesn't it? But I've really grown very, very happy with them. And now that I get to know them, you know, we didn't have many around our home when I was a little kid. In fact, I brought a black boy home from the YMCA one time, and you know, invite him to have dinner with us and stuff. And we had a black maid at that time too. And mother said, "Herbie, what are you doing to us? Don't you know the black should come in the servant's entrance, the back door? You shouldn't bring him in the front door." And I never use the front door. I never use the front door, never. It's always unlocked, but I never use it. But with him, we came up the street and we just went in the front door. And I don't know why, but obviously there was a reason. And everyone in the whole family, you know, was sitting in the living room and looked up and, "Well, hi, Herbie, who you got with you here?" You know, and, you know, they were all amenable to having this fellow. He's a great guy. He danced in the Martha Graham School of Ballet, and they were practicing down at the YMCA, and I was able to practice with them for a couple of hours, which was kind of an exciting experience. And so I just invited him to come home and have supper with us and perhaps stay overnight even if he wanted to, you know, whatever he wanted to do. But, and he did, but mother was very surprised. But you see, we all get that superiority thing. We all get that idea that we're superior to somebody else because we have more money than they do, or we're of a better class than they are, or we have more experience than they do, or something like that. And this is the most silly thing in the world, because some of the most beautiful people in the world are the humble, gentle people who don't put on any class. And then up they come, and they sit down at the piano or something like that, and you say, "My God, are they good? You know, wow." You ever had that happen to you? I've had that happen to me a lot of times, especially at the fraternities in the University of Chicago. You'd go into a room and some little milquetoast would be sitting there at the corner, not doing anything. And then somebody who knew him would say, hey, Pete, come over here a minute. So Peter, yeah, you know, real humble-like. And then say, Pete, how does that song go? And then he'd ask for a song. And Pete says, like this. No, no, play it. You know. And so Peter's going, woo-wee. The whole room shook and looked over at him. And that little milquetoast of a guy, you know, was blasting away on the piano. And it was, the whole building was rattling, you know, because he was good. He knew it. And of course, it was a thunderous piece, and that's what the guy wanted him to play. He wanted to shake everybody up because he liked Pete, and Pete just had such a low self-esteem that his friend was going to help him build it up. Oh, was there an interesting change in the room? The girls realized that he was on the runway, and they came to him, and they gathered around him, and they just sort of snuggled him very nice. And some of the other guys who were more outgoing, they said, how does he do that? And then one or two of us mentioned a little humility, maybe, you know. A little bit of humbleness goes a long way. And it surely did with him. But that was great. I had another friend. He was at Marquette University with me. And he was in a wheelchair. Very brilliant fellow. And a little pudgy and so forth. But I invited him over to my house. And we had to go on the bus, and they didn't have ramps for wheelchairs to go up on buses and stuff like that. So I had to carry him on the bus, and then bring his wheelchair on and stuff like that and carry him off. And I was just a slim Jim myself, but I had worked for my dad in construction, so I had a little bit of bulk on me, as a little muscle, and so I could do that very easily. But when I brought him home, I had to take him upstairs to see my room. You know, that's the only room in the house that's important, was my room, you know. And so he saw that, and his wheelchair even got around in there. But today, as I went to look at the house, I wonder how we ever did that, you know. And then I carried his wheelchair downstairs and carried him downstairs and showed him all over the house. Like, a ranch-style house is so wonderful. You don't have any staircases. But he was just a magnificent person, so humble and so wonderful, but what a genius. He helped me with many of the courses I was taking. When he walked down the runway of my life, he was a fabulous person, really fabulous. I've had a lot of beautiful people who were considered to be milquetoast, or, you know, they were afraid of their own shadow type of thing, but they really weren't. What they were was they didn't want to show off, because they knew when they sat down at the piano, or when they would start explaining things in mathematics or what have you, they would, their brilliance would so shine that everyone else would be eclipsed by the very shadow of their magnificence. But this is what walking down the runway means. Enjoying life. And Snuggles there, he'll be walking down that runway in no time at all. And I think he'll walk down the runway best when he's following somebody. Like Little Love or something, you know. So if you get Little Love to come out, then Snuggles will come too. Mm-hmm. And that's the runway of life.
2, 1, 0.
A magic voice. A magic voice. Who do you know who has a magic voice? That it's so sonorous, so lugubrious, so uplifting and yet quiet and relaxing. Who do you know like that? Who do you know who has a voice that can spin the web of a spider, that can drop pixie dust, that can lift hearts and mend bodies, and turn things from appearances of not nice to nice? Who do you know like that? You know yourself. Each one of you has the voice of magic. And each one of you can be gentle and loving and kind, and you can be upset, and you can be uptight, And you can be sweet, and you can be marvelous, and you can also be caustic and kind of sarcastic and sort of a pain in the neck. All these things you can be. If you have a magic voice, you think that you'd only turn your ideas to magic, only turn your ideas to beautiful thoughts. Why would you turn your ideas to any thoughts which are not beautiful and not positive and not uplifting? That's a good question, isn't it? Well, you know why? You know why? Because it's fun. You're playing a game. Do you think that Button likes to bark? No. He likes to hear himself bark, but he doesn't like to bark especially. When Little Love is out there barking, Button just sits back and watches, you know. When Little Love's not out there barking, then Button has to bark. But why do they bark? They bark because they like to hear themselves bark. They bark, 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 bark. What are you barking at? Nothing. Why are you barking? Because it's fun. And we talk. A lot of times we talk just because we like to hear ourselves talk. Because we like to hear what we have to say. Now, what do I say to all of you as often as I can? I say, tell me what your problem is. I don't need to know it, but you need to know it. You need to know how you really think your problem is. Because most of the time, when you find out how you really think your problem is, you really don't have a problem. By the time you get done talking about it and defining it, you say, well, really there's nothing there to be concerned about. And the only thing to be concerned about is my attitude. And so I start changing my attitude and then everything falls into place. So you see, your magic voice reveals these things. Button went down to the fence yesterday morning as I was leaving, and he was barking. And there's a dog on the other side of the fence barking back at him. And they were talking to each other. And the dog on the other side of the fence couldn't have been very big because it just had a medium bark. You know, it didn't have a big one or a little one. Just sort of a medium bark. And it wasn't a coyote. But Button and he were having a great old conversation. And Button, talking like that, you know. Yeah, they weren't doing that. You know, just like dogs do talk, you know. And so they were having a big conversation, but I was too busy coming up here to stay back and enjoy it. But nonetheless, everyone has a magic voice. And do you have, this is the fun part now. Do you have magic ears that you hear only the magic voices wherever they are being spoken? Do you have magic ears where you can hear the beauty and the goodness of the universe? Do you have magic ears so you can hear the flowers talking? No. You have magic ears so you can hear the hummingbirds and how they're talking? Do you have... You made a note you were going to put it up yesterday, and I thought sure it was up. But do you have magic ears that you can hear the dogs and know what they're talking about? No. Do you have magic ears that you can hear what the cats are saying? A lot of times you think you can. A lot of times you think you have an idea what the cats are talking about. But what are the cats talking about? You can be sure they're talking about beautiful things. Why should a cat talk about anything else? All it does is sleep and go out and run around and have fun. I mean, and we feed them. We house them. We provide everything. And they don't even come to be petted. You got to go to them. Occasionally, Micho will come over and you know, say, pet me. But if something attracts Micho, he is off and gone without a whisper behind to tell you that he's got something else in mind. But we feed him, we house him, we clothe him, we emotionally love them, we pet them when we can reach them, and they don't do anything for it, except to be. They're just cats. Now, why don't you start going to school now and listen and learn what a cat's saying, what it's talking? It might be surprising. You might have great knowledge coming from them. We just haven't learned their language. Now, John has come up here from Kiwidom, and we have tried to understand him, and many times he is indecipherable. And some of our friends who come down from England, speaking the King's English, they too are indecipherable. And then many times there are some Russians who come down from Russia speaking English, and it's indecipherable. But why is it indecipherable? Because whoever was their teacher did not teach them to speak clearly, precisely, and with magic in their voice. Anyone. Now, John, we ask him to read for us occasionally, and when we ask him to read, he puts on his best bib and tucker, and he speaks clearly and distinctly and perfectly, and he sounds just like a radio announcer. That's a compliment. And he sounds very good, very clear, very wonderful. And then, other times, when he's just chit-chatting and sharing ideas, he uses that Kiwi vernacular, and it's hard to understand. Now, Ingeborg has a voice that'll reach from here to Helongong, you know, and further. But Ingeborg thinks that she is not important, and so she mumbles and eats her words. Ingeborg, you have something to say. You are a very wonderful and important person. Open your mouth and talk.
Well, Herb, you put your hearing aids on, you can hear me.
All right, I'll put them on. And I still don't hear you. Because you speak away from us when you're speaking. Like oftentimes when you're speaking, you speak to Ellen on the other end of the table instead of speaking to all of us. Now, it's true if you're speaking to someone, you usually speak to them. But here is a rule at this table. There are no private conversations. Everything involves everybody. Everything is spoken up. So we get,
why no private conversations? Don't I have a right to have?
No. Nope. You have no rights here. No rights whatsoever. The only thing you have a right to do is to follow the rules. And the rules are that there's no private conversations. But why? Because we are all one. We're all together here. We're all sharing like one. If you want a private conversation, take somebody in the bathroom or go in your office, you know. But here at the table, it is all shared. And if you think of something private, just make a little note and go and talk about it later. But here, everything is shared. We have the magic of the voice being expressed here, the magic of our inner self. Now, if you want to listen to a dog and hear what he's saying, you must first learn his language, his vocabulary. Now, can you learn a dog's vocabulary? Or you listen in your heart. And what do you hear?
All the goodness and happiness and love.
You hear all the goodness and the happiness and love that a dog is. Do you like doing that?
Yes, I do.
Why do you like doing that?
It's an outpicturing of my inner self.
Mm-hmm. And what is it in reality? It's being one as all, right?
Mm-hmm. And we all want to be one as all, don't we?
We are.
We are. It's so easy to drift away and not pay attention to everybody else. But we're all here to share with each other. What did they say about Donald Simoda when he was speaking to the crowds? The one next to him and the one farthest from him could hear equally well whatever he had to say. Remember that? What did they say about Jesus and the Sermon on the Mount? He could be heard equally as well by those around him and those at the farthest away. Everyone heard. But how did he do that? Well, these are things that is none of your business. It's absolutely none of your business how people do these things. Because you haven't earned the right to know these things. And to earn the right to know these things, you do this. You first find out who you are. You listen within yourself. You go in introspection and you find out what's going on inside of you. And once you find out what's going on inside of you, you'll recognize that you are the allness. And then you will recognize what's going on inside of Ingeborg or Sylvia, Anita or Ellen, or John or Herb. You'll recognize. But you won't recognize it unless you listen within yourself. Now, Sylvia can say, John, do you hear the hummingbirds? And John says, no. Sylvia says, don't you hear the hummingbirds? John says, no. John, turn around, look out the window. What do you see? Hummingbirds. Now do you hear them? Oh, yeah. Now, until he had his attention on the hummingbirds, he didn't hear them. Now, did John hear the hummingbirds through his ears or through his heart? Do we learn and understand things through our ears, through our eyes, through our nose, our touch? No, we learn it through our heart. Our heart being our entunement with our divine self. This is what we want to do. This is what we want to clue into. This is the magic of our words. And this magic word that we want to speak is, oh, yes. You acknowledge it and you hear it. But then John is going to come in here and John's going to say, boy, those ants are sure making a lot of noise. And did you hear those crickets going up the wall? And that salamander that was running along the sidewalk out there, can you hear him? And what did Kung Fu's master say to him? Or what did he call him?
Grasshopper.
Grasshopper. Why did he call him grasshopper?
It's chirped.
Because when he was being taught in his early years, the blind teacher said to him, look at that grasshopper next to you. And he looked down. How did you know it was there? It's so quiet. You know, how did you know? And the boy took on the name of grasshopper at that point. But you see, when we can listen to our hearts, listen to our soul, listen to the divine within us, we'll hear all these things. What's the big deal about listening to a grasshopper? Nothing. But what's the big deal about listening to anything? You listen to your heart, and then all things are revealed to you, and it's kind of fun. But that's your choice, that's your decision, and that's for you. Now, do you have this magic voice? Do you have this magic ability to be tuned in? No, you don't. You don't until you learn to listen within yourself. Until you learn to do your introspection. Over the years now, introspection has become off and on again, sort of a happy, unhappy thing because we didn't get anything, don't get any results. But anybody who sincerely does the introspection, who sincerely listens, sincerely gets results. If you really want to hear what God as you and you as God has to say, then you listen. You don't need to go into introspection to know it. But you have to do what introspection does of you, listening within. Because you can walk along the street and listen within. You could be typing stories and all of a sudden, boom, hey, that's a neat idea. Where'd it come from, you know? You listen within. Fantastic. Where do the right words come from when you're counseling with somebody and you have no idea what they need? Boom, it's there. Because you listen within. And you do not give advice. You guide them to find it within themselves. But you sort of encourage them to look at different avenues. Have you considered getting a different boyfriend? Have you considered going to another town? Have you considered, well, I like it here and I like this boyfriend I got right now and I like this here? Well, then what are you going to do? You're telling me the boyfriend is rotten and bad and unhappy. What are you going to do? I mean, do you want to live with that sort of situation? Well, no. Well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What you should do, you know, that's not good. What are you going to do? And you say, well, I really like him. Well, what are you going to do about it? Well, I'm going to start telling him I like it. That's interesting. And what are you going to do? I'm going to really like him. I don't have to tell him.